Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusik Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Parker James. Parker is a vibraphone player who plays in the jazz scene here in Nashville with his trio and also records with various artists around town.
If you are listening to this episode on Spotify or any other platform, you're going to want to head on over to our YouTube channel at Rusik Podcast. Over there, you can check out live performances from all of our guests, including Parker's episode. Give us a follow, subscribe, like all the videos. It helps us out a ton. Yeah, same thing. Like, I can't fucking sight read.
Well,
yeah.
It's also
it's not there anymore.
I feel like in school, your teachers are like, oh, this is really important. Like, you're going to need to know this stuff. And then still to this day, I've never once had to do it. And
yeah. Depends on what world you're in.
Yeah, for sure. If you're like in the classical world or.
Yeah, I'm sure in the classical world, it's more applicable.
Have you ever had to sight read on a gig or anything? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I sight read earlier this week doing a recording session.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
So I do it a lot.
Music school is worth it.
I'm getting better at it. And nice. One of my goals is to become do more session work.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, doing a lot of those recording sessions, you have to be a monster sight reader, especially on mallets.
That makes sense.
You know, you have to just be like the guy who played the xylophone on all like the Danny Elfman soundtrack stuff, like the Simpsons theme. I forget his name. But he was just like a legend in LA. And that was basically his whole thing was that he was an incredible sight reader.
Yeah.
Like kind of a shitty improviser.
No, but think like that. If your job is like, here's a piece of music, record this fast and cheaply for me so we're done. Like that guy is making some money.
Yeah, it's like we got the caterers here.
Exactly. Like we're not come on, time is of the essence.
Yeah,
let's go,
we got 3 hours to record 90 songs.
Yeah.
That's usually what it's like, you know, and it's just like
no, if that's your skill set you're going for, that's a smart way to do it.
Yeah, and the way those sessions often work is you do one take. If you made a mistake, you have to raise your hand and confess. Because if you don't, they're gonna find it later.
Yeah.
And they're gonna never hire you again.
That's brutal.
Yeah,
that's,
it is brutal.
That's interesting.
Brutal.
Yeah.
So I think I've learned that one of the keys is to confess early in the session, so then everyone just assumes that
that you're on top of it.
You're on top of it.
Oh, and that's smart.
Have you ever had that where someone calls you the next day and is like, "Hey, why didn't you say anything?"
Not me personally, thank God. I don't do enough of that session work for that to really matter yet.
That's good.
But
wait, so you got in the vibraphone through playing percussion. What was the transition like? Was this the first pitched instrument? Was this the first instrument pitched in this way, I should say, that you'd ever taken on, or did you have experience with other instruments before that?
We had an upright piano at home that I would just sort of fuck around on.
Cool.
Is this a family podcast?
No, you can say whatever the hell you want.
just checking. So I fucked around on that piano. And I didn't do anything. My mom was like, you should take piano lessons. And I did, and I hated it.
Yeah. I feel like no kid sits down at piano lessons and is ever like, oh, I love this. Like,
yeah. My piano teacher was 140 years old.
And they're all old.
I think when you're young, too, like, the piano is not cool. Like, that's what all the nerds play.
No. You know? I remember my grandma saying...
Like Billy Joel's guy.
Yeah. My grandma was like, oh, you should learn piano. There's people who play pianos are so much fun at parties. And I said, like, Grandma, it's not 1930 anymore.
Yeah, it's not.
I mean, it's kind of true,
anymore.
But like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
so that gave you some kind of context for when you took on the vibraphone then.
Yeah. But I definitely was a drummer. Mm-hmm. I got my first drum set when I was, I think, for my fourth birthday.
Okay.
I came downstairs and there was big boxes in the family room.
Oh.
And my dad had gotten like a starter drum set for me, which is, it was a real drum set. But it had, he had emblazoned on the bass drum, the Beatles, and then Parker James underneath it.
Oh,
and
nice.
I just went ape shit because that was
amazing.
Like the only thing I knew was the Beatles at that time.
Yeah.
That's a good starting place.
So I was super interested. And apparently like I had this thing for about, you know, 2 months, and then I came down to my dad and I said, Dad, I think I need a hi-hat. And he didn't even know I knew what a hi-hat was. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know I knew, but apparently I wanted one.
So the starter kit didn't have a hi-hat?
No, it was like a tiny little kick drum, a snare, a tom, and then a cymbal mounted on the bass drum.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha.
But it was enough for me at the time.
Yeah,
but I guess
to kind of get going.
Yeah, but I guess I thought I needed a hi-hat.
Yeah.
So then I fourth grade rolls around in New York State. We started in fourth grade in band, did a lot of drums. We did a little bit of mallets, but it was never something I was into. I was always just like, I just got to get through this so I can play the big timpani, you know?
Of course.
That's what I wanted to do, play drum set in the jazz band. And then eighth grade rolls around, we moved to Indiana, which is probably the worst grade you can possibly move anywhere. Because it's like, I was like, yeah,
as someone who teaches eighth grade, that's the worst grade to move.
Totally. I was like, oh, I'm just getting cool at my old school, which I'm sure I was not cool, but I thought I was. So I get to eighth grade and it's just brutal socially. So I just was kind of retreated into music and I was listening. Mm-hmm. At that time, I had just discovered LimeWire. So I was downloading like Led Zeppelin.
The good old days.
You know, I would download a track and it would say like, Knocking on Heaven's Door, Led Zeppelin, Guns N' Roses, Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
It was like it'd be like nine artists.
And you download it, it'd just be something completely different. And you'd have to download like two more just until you finally got the right song.
Yeah.
Then go in and rename them all properly.
Oh, yeah. I was very invested in that.
And then your computer got AIDS. And
yes. I really wanted my iTunes to be as clean as possible.
Oh, same. That was like a point of like honor for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. Oh, that's a smart way to be, I feel like.
Yeah. So yeah, I downloaded like Knocking on Heaven's Door and it's had all those artists listed at, and it was like some live version. And I was like, this must have been the greatest concert of all time. All these guys are on this track. But I don't know who the hell.
That's hilarious.
I literally think it was just Guns N' Roses or something.
That's so funny.
So anyway, eighth grade, no friends yet. And I'm just listening to music a ton. Getting into super dorky music like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Oh, nice. That's a good choice, though.
Yeah, my dad was instrumental in that, too, because he had an insane record collection. Mm-hmm. And starting in the late 80s, he switched to CDs, and he had a really good CD player and all this giant cabinet full of just like jazz fusion.
Oh, cool.
Progressive rock, and then all the classics. He was a huge Beatles head, too. So I just raided that cabinet basically, and
it's
just started
starting point
putting that on my iPod Classic 30 gigs. And then I think in eighth grade I did my final band concert of eighth grade, and my friends were like, so are you going to marching band on Tuesday? And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about, marching band? We didn't have that in New York really. Uh-huh. So I didn't know what that was about. And they're like, are you signed up for band next year? I said, yeah. They're like, you're in marching band. Hate to break it to you. I was like, fuck. Nah. So that's my whole summer, man. So I go to marching band and I hated that too for a little bit, but eventually it clicked, mm-hmm. you know, something about just like practicing all the time. I don't know. I really enjoyed the camaraderie of it. And I was kind of off to the races as a drummer there.
I feel like at that age too, that's kind of where it either clicks or doesn't. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like when you're roughly around that age and you start to put the time in and realize, oh, if I practice, I get a little less shitty. Like that's totally the coolest feeling in the world. Yeah. When you're a kid and you realize, I mean, I think you can graph that out to anything in life. But I think for at least us who, for better or worse, have decided on music and fell in love with music, when you're that age and you start to put that time in, and you realize, oh, I can be less crappy at this. It's the best feeling in the world. Because then you realize, like, oh, that's true of, like, anything. It's awesome. It's a good way to learn that lesson.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, music really taught me how to teach myself, I think. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky to have a really good teacher in that freshman year. My drum teacher, Marcel Coulomb, who is equal parts drummer, marching band drummer, rudimental snare drummer, marched in Star of Indiana, like all those drum corps back in the 90s that were really, really like legendary. And he was also a jazz piano player, so he wasn't square at all. Like,
oh, wow.
He always smelled like cigarettes and weed, and he's still a good friend to this day. I hope he's watching. Hey, Mark. He really kind of set me straight. I think I was talented, but I was not practicing. Like, I think I was doing like a solo and ensemble, like multi-percussion piece. And there was one specific lesson where he was listening to me play and I could tell he was just not having it, you know, like my bullshit. I was bullshitting my way through this thing, you know, hadn't practiced. And he was like, man, I don't get it. You're so talented, but you're just coasting. Like, why don't you show up and actually do something? And all I remember after that was I was practicing all the time after that. He flipped some sort of switch in my like teenage lizard brain. Yeah. That, like, I was like a boat, you know, going and just sort of a, going in one direction. He just kind of nudged me in another direction.
I find looking back on it, my best teachers were always the ones that were hardest on me. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think you need someone to be like, hey, get your shit together.
Hey, you stupid fuck. You're, you know, what are you doing here? You're wasting your time.
Yeah, I've had a lot of teachers that are just too nice.
Yeah. He was not too nice. He was always really honest.
Yeah, and that's
when,
good.
And when I taught, I strove to be like that too. You know, I mean, you don't want to be an asshole.
Yeah, there's a line for sure.
There is a line.
And it's recognizing too, those for whom this means something to can take a little bit more.
Yes.
And if someone you recognize that there is potential in someone and that there's hopefully some kind of passion there.
Mm-hmm.
You might need to be a little more stern with your direction.
You know?
Whereas like, you know, it's like not everyone's going to be a musician nor should they be. And everyone's not going to have that passion. So it's like, I think recognizing as a teacher, when you see someone like yourself as a young person that is interested in that and like has potential there, but just, maybe they're not putting the time in or whatnot. I think that says a lot about you as a person. You as a person, as a student, and as a teacher, to recognize that and try to course correct, because we need that. I think we need that with all kinds of things in life. But
yeah, absolutely.
I have no fucking idea. What is the history of the vibraphone? Like, as an instrument,
here we go. I have no. I knew like, this was coming.
I have so many stupid questions I've asked, because like my only real knowledge of a vibraphone is like, you know, like Bobby Hutcherson or something like that. You know what I mean? Like it's so limited to like a very small sect of like jazz music, which I love, but like I have no real not like what is the history of the instrument?
Well, it did start as a jazz instrument. It was invented pretty much like 100 years ago. It's really a recent instrument.
Yeah, that is new.
Yeah, my grandma's about the same age as the vibraphone.
Wow, yeah, that's wild.
It was kind of it started. Mallet instruments have been around for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. Like they come from Africa primarily. Xylophones. Various, you know, instruments that were pitched, you know, and have been slowly changed over the years, evolved.
Yeah.
The xylophone, I think, entered the orchestra probably in the late 1800s. And in the early 20th century, there were a lot of companies, especially in America, in Chicago and Indianapolis, like Deegan and Leedy are two of the big companies, those two cities, respectively. They were sort of competing for different strange mallet instruments. Like we have these steel marimbas, which a marimba is kind of like a xylophone. It's made of wood, but the range is lower. Mm-hmm. The bars are bigger, a little bit richer, woody texture to it. You play with soft mallets as opposed to hard mallets with a xylophone. So they started experimenting with steel marimbas where the bars were made of steel instead of wood. Mm. And we kind of get this competition back and forth between Deegan and Leedy, where I think one company added a pedal to it so you could dampen it like a piano pedal.
Oh, okay.
So you could have short notes and long notes. Because if you play a steel marimba and just hit it, it'll just ring forever.
Yeah.
So if you have a dampener on it, it's just a felt pad, basically, that dampens the note. Then you can play short notes and long notes. And then one of the other companies, I forget which one added which, but the other company added the motor, which is how we eventually came to have the vibraphone as we know it today. The motor is just a little electric motor mounted on the frame, and it spins these little fans that are in the resonators. And it's just a tremolo effect, just a straight up novelty effect.
No, it's funny. Like when you were setting up, cause like we've played gig together and I've played with vibraphone and I've never like seen one set up close though.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were doing it, I was like, oh, this is just like essentially my Wurlitzer, but with, like, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, that's really fucking cool.
Yeah. So the resonators, the big tubes that hang down, that's the amplifier.
Uh-huh.
Cause if you just hit the metal bars by themselves, just hanging in the air, it wouldn't sound like much.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be very loud.
Makes sense.
So the resonator, there's a mathematical formula you can use to figure out how long the resonator needs to be. The higher the pitch, the shorter the resonator.
Okay, yeah.
So that's the amplifier. The sound goes in, bounces at the bottom, and comes back up the top.
Gotcha.
So that those fans there are basically just blocking the resonator and opening the resonator.
Makes
They're
sense.
Just spinning. So yeah, it's just a goofy little novelty effect, and they called it the vibraphone. I think Deegan called it the vibraphone first, and that was, I think, 1927.
Wow, so yeah, we're coming right up on 100 years. That's crazy.
Yeah. Some people date the beginning of the vibes as 1920, which I think was when Leedy introduced their version that didn't have the motor. So the Wikipedia article is just very in-depth on that shit. Look it up. You'll learn all this stuff, all the people, Henry Schluter, all those guys.
I think it's such a unique instrument. Because, so one of the classes that I teach at my school is a music technology class. And one of the things that I show the kids is the history of different instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And the ancestors of vibraphone are, I mean, some of the oldest instruments that we have. So I think it's so interesting to see how it kind of takes its form now in such a recent way. Because mallet instruments they've been around for, like you said, thousands of years. It's such a unique form for it to take right now. And it's such an expressive instrument. Like, there's so much you can do. There's so many ways you can voice melody on it. It's really beautiful. Like, I've
for it has sure. a very, very clean, pure sound.
Yeah.
Like a Rhodes.
Yeah, it really does.
But it's more percussive. Mm-hmm. And you can affect the tone with your mallet choice, harder mallets, softer mallets. There's a lot of extended techniques you can use. You can use bows on it to create sort of effects. You can pitch bend on them. Mm-hmm. You can dampen with mallets. So you could leave the pedal down, let it all ring together, but you can dampen notes with your mallet. So you can take notes out as you need.
Interesting.
Yeah, another thing I wanted to ask you too. I'm just going to keep throwing stupid, ignorant vibraphone questions. So you have like
most people don't even know that it's a vibraphone. So
the big xylophone.
The big xylophone. I would say like 75% of people call it a xylophone.
That's funny.
Not even an exaggeration.
So you have
okay.
You have your bag of mallets. Are all of those? Is the difference of those? I mean, I can imagine it's maybe size of mallet, weight of mallet. Like what's going to dictate
probably.
The hardness? Like what's going to dictate your mallet choice for a particular song?
Well, there's a couple things you can do to change your tone on a mallet. Mm-hmm. I work at a mallet factory here in town. So I've learned a lot about this in the past 4 years since I moved to Nashville. The weight of the core. So every mallet has a core, which is usually rubber or wood or some other type of material. There's different hardnesses of rubber. I've learned this. You can order different hardnesses, you know.
I love that anything in the world gets down to this level of like minute detail.
Yeah.
I love it. It's the coolest. It's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, there's like
doesn't matter what it is.
There are instruments that measure the hardness of rubber, which is such a specific thing that I never knew before. But yeah, you can have harder rubber, softer rubber. You can wrap things around the core, like latex or something. We have a custom machine at work where you can stretch the latex out, put the mallet in, and then snaps around it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Or you can put some sort of felt strip around it.
Gotcha.
And then we have a mallet wrapping machine, also custom, that wraps the mallet in yarn. And there's different choices of yarn you can use. You can use cord yarn, which is much thinner. Usually that's what you use for vibes. Marimba, you'll use maybe like alpaca yarn or some sort of wool blend. And there's different ways of sewing it up because every mallet has to be finished by hand. We have a machine that wraps it, but then you have to actually sew it so that it doesn't come unraveled.
Oh, okay.
And you can do circle stitching around it for cosmetic features and for durability. So there's lots of different choices. And you can make a mallet softer by adding more yarn, more wraps.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a softer core, a larger core. You can put metal inserts in the core to make it heavier so you get more of the fundamental out of the bar.
So when
lots
you're,
of choices.
Again, they're just going to keep coming at you. So when you're playing, do different vibraphone players use different numbers of mallets per hand, or is it like an established two and two that's kind of the norm?
It's pretty standard.
Okay.
Some mallet players just play with one in each.
Okay.
Milt Jackson, Bobby Hutcherson, they weren't really four mallet players. Mm. Gary Burton was kind of the godfather. My grip, the Burton grip, is named after him, which is one of the standard grips that people use.
And then, sorry.
It doesn't really go beyond that.
Gotcha.
You can do six mallet, but you kind of just like, it's like a claw.
That makes sense.
You can't really affect anything.
And then when you're playing, are all of your mallets, do they tend to be uniform, or will you have, like, let's say this hand you have, you know, two different kinds, and this hand you'll have two different kinds, or do you tend to want to have a uniform sound for all of the mallets you're using?
For what I do, I'm using the same mallet.
Okay.
Because I'm improvising most of the time. So gotcha. I need to be able to do anything at any time.
Yeah, with each mallet. Okay.
And it might limit if I have a different mallet.
Makes sense.
But for some classical literature, like on marimba, they'll use what are called graduated sets, where it's like the lowest one is softest, and then it gets harder as you go up.
Oh, okay. That's kind of cool.
But yeah, it's kind of, that's very in the weeds.
Yeah.
Very, very specific.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. I mean, I'll go all fucking day talking about this shit. Let's do it.
So when you, I know, like, when you compose music, how is it as a compositional instrument? Do you find that it's like, what are the pros and cons in that regard?
Well, it's only three octaves. So my lowest note is the F below middle C.
Okay.
And they make bigger ones, but mine is just three octaves.
That's a big enough instrument.
Is that standard size for a...
Yeah, that's standard. So when I'm writing, I'm usually writing tunes for my trio. I have a jazz trio, vibraphone, bass, drums. So I'm writing lead sheets. I'm writing a melody and chords, and then I'm taking it to those guys, and we're figuring out style and
what
we're going to do with it. So my composition style is really loose in that regard. It's jazz. You know?
I feel like that's the way to write. I mean, it's interesting because I feel like so many piano players, it can be different, but I do feel melody, chord changes, and then arrangement after that that's usually the way to go. But it's, I guess my mind was curious only because I think a vibraphone is kind of laid out in a similar way to a piano, obviously. And so I feel like some piano players compose to piano, if that makes sense, as opposed to like the segregation between melody, here's the harmony that interplays with it, and then you can kind of freely arrange from there. But I think that's interesting that you do it that way. Yeah.
Sometimes I do write on piano. Mm-hmm. But even then, I'm still writing chords and melody. I'm a chords guy. I love chords. I love harmony. It's one of the things that draws me to like J.S. Bach and Brian Wilson. Is just the fluidity of their harmonies. It's always fascinated me, even as a kid.
And I also feel like as a songwriter, when you have a phenomenal chord progression, if you're writing a song and you have a chord progression that's guiding you, that chord progression will tell you what the melody's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you're really kind of paying attention as a songwriter, oh, it's the best feeling when you say, oh, like it, that, I love that. I love that feeling of exploration and it almost like revealing itself with good harmony.
Yeah. Well, I'm starting to think of chords and harmonies more as colors. I'm not synesthetic. I wish I was kind of, but I don't know. Maybe it seems like it's almost like perfect pitch. Maybe it's more of a blessing than a curse.
Yeah.
I think like I tend to like, I love living in these worlds. Like I look at chords as like this world here and then this world here. And the scales that the chords suggest.
Mm-hmm.
I love just sort of like blending those colors and painting them onto a canvas and then say, okay, I feel like I need to stay on this chord longer because this color isn't bright enough.
Yeah.
Or I need to change this color a little bit, so I'm going to make this one note like a half step lower, you know, and make it a different chord. Yeah.
Vibraphone seems like a great instrument to do that on because you have so much like sustain and can kind of...
Yes.
Yeah.
But also because I only have four mallets, I have to choose my notes carefully.
Yeah.
So I don't have all the freedom in the world. I can make things ring, which is sweet, but I really only have four notes that I can play if I'm doing block chords. It doesn't even go that low, so I don't have bass under me.
Yeah, I almost feel as though, and I love piano. I really compose, at least at this point in my life, for half a decade now, I've really only composed, or at least primarily composed on piano. Piano is almost so open that at times can be difficult because you're trying to feel, okay, like where are the edges here? Because there's so much you can do with piano in terms of harmony and just the amount of fingers you have to use. There's a lot you can do. There has to almost be something really beautiful about the restriction of vibraphone, and having to compositionally be so tight with your harmony and melody and know, like, mm-hmm. no, like, this note has to count. There's got to be something really nice about composing in that way.
Yeah. Well, I had a really influential composition teacher in college named Jody Nagel, who was always stressing the importance of parameters when you're writing, because music is just like, God, like,
yeah.
I just, when I think about music, my mind just goes, like, it goes insane, you know? Which is, I guess, kind of a trite thing to say, but I mean, it really is kind of mind-boggling, the possibilities sometimes. So having just sort of really tight parameters can really force you into making choices that you wouldn't normally make.
For sure. Yeah.
Like, he taught us an exercise to, you only get two chords and you have to make something happen with these two chords. It could be any major or minor chord out of all the 12 notes. You can pick, like, you could do like a C major and an F sharp minor.
Okay.
Don't worry about keys. Don't worry about anything. Just
no relationship.
Yeah.
Like, just preconceived relationship. Just establish two chords. That's interesting.
Yeah. And then just explore the relationship between the two and try to make something happen there. Mm-hmm. Right. Like a minute long composition with that.
Yeah. That's a great kind of project for improvisation too, because I mean, I'm such a modal person when I listen to music. Like, I don't know why, but that's kind of like the way I was always taught. And I think my mind looks at patterns with harmony through a very modal lens.
Mm-hmm.
And just being able to isolate and say, okay, what are the relationship between this chord and the chord we're about to be on? And like have that beautiful moment of like, hey, if everything else is sort of out the window and I'm just looking at it through the prism of these two chords, what can be done there? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a great tool for improvising. I'm going to need to mess around with that somewhere.
I do that all the time. Just put certain restrictions on myself. Otherwise there's just too much.
Yeah.
Too many
options. It's just too much.
Sometimes
limiting
your options can make you, you know,
gives
you a little spark.
As an improviser, I did not know how to practice improvising for the longest time. Because I just didn't, I would get in the practice room and I'd be like, well, what now?
Yeah.
It's like, I have this tune to learn. How do I learn this tune? It's just chords and a melody.
Yeah.
And I could do any number of things. So I had to learn, I had to like invent little games and exercises mm-hmm. for myself to make it so that I had some sort of structure, but also freedom to improvise within that structure. Yeah. And I think parameters really kind of played into that.
Can you give an example of that? I'm curious.
Well, I've been getting into this thing where when I'm learning a tune, I'll just put on a metronome. You know, if it's a swing tune, I'll just put it on 2 and 4 and I'll just go through and play all the root notes of all the chords. So something like a blues, I would play like F2 3 4 B flat 2 3 4 F2 3 4 F2 3 4
So just something to link you to the
song. To link you to it. And then I'll go up to the third and play the third of every chord. A 2 3 4 D 2
gotcha.
3 4 A, mm-hmm. and then the fifth, the seventh, the ninth.
Uh-huh.
And then once you've done all that and you feel comfortable with that, you can start changing it up. You can go play the root of the first chord and then the fifth of the second chord,
mm-hmm.
or the third of the.
That's a great little routine to get. Yeah, like I find I do something. I always learn. Like, even if I'm just like comping on something, I always want to have the melody in my head if I'm going to solo over something or whatever.
Yeah.
Cause I think you just need something to link you to really link you to the song. And little exercises like that can go a super long way. I like the like routine of that. I think that's really,
You got to kind of systematize it somehow because otherwise you'll just never make any progress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the best jazz musicians were just insane practicers and just had to come up with their own solutions. Like John Coltrane.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's probably the most like extreme.
I was thinking about insane practicers earlier today, I guess, as everyone does. But
you want to feel bad about yourself. You
know? But if you listen to a recording of John Coltrane when he's like 23, he like kind of sucks.
I was gonna say he's like not that good.
He's like not doing it. He's definitely not Coltrane yet.
Yeah.
He's like kind of making the changes, but not really. And for whatever reason, and when he was growing up in Philly, he wasn't getting all the good gigs yet. So he always just had to sort of like find his own solutions because it didn't come naturally to him. He was a late bloomer. He had to figure out why he wasn't getting the good gigs. And you can hear it. If you just go through his discography, you can hear his different periods, like his sheets of sound period or his free period where he's really just figuring it out.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's like, that's the beauty of all of us. I mean, it's the journey, as silly as it sounds. I mean, like,
yeah,
that's the process is the thing that's so wonderful. And
otherwise it's boring.
Yeah, exactly. And getting to see someone who is such a giant throughout those different moments of life, and to recognize as a listener that, oh, there's tension here. There's someone trying to get better at something. I think that's the most inspirational thing in the world.
Yeah, I think that's why there's a church based around John Coltrane, because he was a searcher, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, he died at right when he was reaching, you know, enlightenment, you know, in his playing, you know, he was playing at his freest when at the time that he died. So he's been mythologized, you know, since then.
It's a good time to go. I'm not quite there yet, but you know.
Yeah. I hope I have a few more good years in me, for sure. Wait,
so you, at this point, what's your relationship to playing percussion instruments?
Well, since I moved to Nashville about 4 years ago, it's been all vibraphone all the time, pretty much. Before that, I was teaching a lot in Indianapolis, doing private lessons, teaching marching band, playing a lot more drum set.
Gotcha.
Before that, I was in grad school and I was doing a lot of orchestral playing.
Okay.
So I was playing with orchestras, doing regional gigs, played timpani at a Catholic church in Denver when I lived out there. So I've done a lot of different things in percussion. Played in Brazilian baterias.
I don't know what that is.
Latin
jazz
spicy ensemble. Yeah. Well, CU Boulder had a Latin jazz ensemble and a Brazilian drum line.
Okay.
And that just really taught me a lot, exposing me to different types of playing, different ways of conceiving of the drum, you know, which is an ancient instrument.
As a listener, what do you listen to primarily at this point?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's
but like, what's on current rotation, I guess?
Oh man. I mean, right now I'm listening to a ton of Beach Boys because Brian Wilson just died. So that's why I played Don't Talk But Your Head on My Shoulder.
That was beautiful, by the way. That sounded...
Thank you.
I have never taken the deep dive on Brian Wilson. I've listened to the Beach Boys albums, or at least, you know, the big ones, and I really do enjoy them. But I can tell, like, I'm getting an itch that that's going to be coming my way soon to, like, really take that deep dive.
I mean, it's fascinating. There's so much there with... just Pet Sounds. Mm-hmm. His whole career obviously was stunning, but Pet Sounds is, it's one of those records where I think I first listened to it when I was in high school and I didn't quite get it at first, but I remember I was driving home from college once, driving back from Muncie, Indiana to Westfield, Indiana, just all these back roads. It was summertime. My freshman year in the can, I'm feeling like an adult. I'm 19 years old and I'm listening to Pet Sounds in my 99 Jeep Cherokee. And I was like, I get it now, you know,
like
I don't know why, but, I was just like, the windows were down. It just felt right. I mean, his, as a composer, I really was drawn to his harmonies, his chords, the sheer melodicism. Because he's an incredible singer, and all those guys in the Beach Boys were just so, their vocals were just so stunning, and it's so rich. All that close harmony was just like, it just rings.
And
you know?
Think that all of those records, or at least you know the records of that era for them, were done on like 4-track, like just on a technical level. The fact that they pulled that off is amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, that's incredible.
Just bouncing and bouncing and bouncing,
oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And Pet Sounds, what made that such a firm break was that it was mostly him. I think the rest of the band was on the road for a lot of it. And he was like a kid in a candy store. He had all these musicians there and he was teaching them a lot of their parts by rote, which is incredible to me. Because I listened to his percussion writing, for example, and it's so logical. It makes so much sense. They all have a compositional logic unto themselves if you were to just listen to them. But he's just teaching it by rote, and they're bringing their own ideas, and he was receptive to it. And when you listen to it, it just becomes this beautiful, rich whole that I think is kind of untouchable to this day, you know? And it's the sound of that studio, the sound of the reverb in that studio, the amazing musicians that were on that, just... It's the whole package for me.
I'm going to tackle some more Beach Boys soon. That's, yes. I can feel it coming up.
Yeah. It's really, really beautiful stuff. And it was a huge influence on me. So when he died, I was, I knew it was coming at some point, mm-hmm. but it's just been giving me a lot of reflection to be like, wow, how has this music affected me? And we're at a point now where all the greats are going, you know, one by one. I don't know what I'm going to do when Paul McCartney dies. I'm probably going to go to a mountaintop and sit.
Yeah, we should all just take a week and not speak or something. I've been listening to, I grew up a big Beatles fan, but probably the past 6 months, I've been going back through a lot of that and seriously listening to it in a way I haven't in quite a while. Some of that Beatles stuff, even the early stuff, is just the composition's incredible. Mm-hmm. The actual technical recording of it is incredible. I mean, some of it's just mind blowing how good some of that writing and performance is.
Yeah, I think, Lennon and McCartney are like, I put them up there with like Schubert and
it's amazing.
And like all those amazing guys who were writing.
They're
as
not
far
even
as
my
songwriter.
Favorite Beatles songwriter. No, I'm just kidding.
but I mean, as far as just sheer output, like the amount of good
songs. Unbelievable.
Incredible.
Like their batting average is fucking insane.
Yeah.
Put on any one of those Beatles albums and you're like, oh man, I need to go home and practice.
Yeah. But I would put Pet Sounds as a whole above any Beatles record. That might be controversial. I think the Beatles output as a whole is stronger than the Beach Boys, but you know, I think Pet Sounds.
Fighting words. Let's go. Yeah.
I'm gonna listen to that.
My
album
email
today.
Is if you want to.
The real question is who would win in a fist fight? Beatles
nobody
or
email me. I don't care what you have to say. I'm the guest here.
Fight about it in the comments.
There you go. Exactly.
Yeah. There you go.
Exactly.
You go off into your comments.
Yeah. You lowly scum. So you were saying earlier that the Beatles was some of the first stuff that grabbed your attention. As a kid.
Sorry,
Kitty. She's kind of
look
a psycho.
At you.
She's being, wow.
That's okay.
Go down.
Kitty. Get down. So you were saying the Beatles was some of the stuff that really grabbed your attention as a young person. Because I feel like all of us, like we were talking about that at that age when you kind of get addicted to this thing, we have the stuff that is really just doing it for us.
Yeah.
When you were 12, 13, 14, what was the music that kind of turned you on to, I want to do that?
It was probably Led Zeppelin.
There you go.
Just really
enough
hilarious
said.
To say.
Enough said. No.
I'm serious, though.
You have no idea how much we've talked about Zeppelin on this because Brian and I both love some Led Zeppelin. Of all of the shit that you listen to at that age, Zeppelin fucking holds up.
Zeppelin,
Pink Floyd, some of that stuff
Pink
is
Floyd
just
too.
Like fire.
Definitely in the top few that originally got me started. For sure.
Yeah, it was John Bonham was just such an undeniable drummer, and that at that point in time, I was like, I'm a drummer. Mm-hmm. I was wearing headbands. I had long hair.
Nice.
There you
if you looked up pictures of me from like freshman year of high school, I looked like a fucking idiot.
You know? I have a feeling all of us.
I for sure did.
That's okay. Yeah, 2006, like just like wearing the worst fitting clothes, wearing cargo shorts and like a giant Grateful Dead like shirt that was like.
Still love
3XL. Led Zeppelin was just a huge one for me. Just like I loved shredders at mm-hmm. that time.
I had a shred phase too.
Yeah, that's why I was into progressive rock too, because I was like, I just want to hear like badasses play music in a badass way.
Of course.
I still love a lot of that stuff.
it has its moments.
The shred stuff, but I like progressive music in general.
Honestly, some of it just as songs are beautiful. I mean, some of the melodies are great, and like as crazy as it can be, some of it's really great music.
Yeah, Yes still holds up really well.
Yes is fantastic. Yes. Yeah.
You know what I miss that I'm sure some people are still doing it, but I wish was more prevalent is concept albums.
Mm-hmm.
I love an album that's just one giant composition, and I wish more people did that these days, but it seems like much less common than it was.
Which is funny, because like, I feel like there's such a place for that right now, and there's such a...
I feel like people's attention spans are kind of waning a little bit.
I just mean in terms of actually being able to assemble something like that. It's so much easier now to be able to put something like that together.
I'm sure there's somebody doing it. I just don't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, the streaming services kind of de-emphasize albums as a whole.
Yeah.
It's singles, baby. So yeah. it really is sad. Kind of incentivizing artists to just release like singles, you know?
Yeah. My last full length album came out 5 years ago now, which is insane. And since then I've just put out like a handful of singles, and that's the way that people do it now. And I'm getting to a point where I'm like, fuck it, I just need to do another album. Like cause as a consumer, that's how I like to listen to music. I like to put on an album and totally. I want to hear the album, you know? And at a certain point it's like, yes, I think, you know, like if you're doing anything, you want to make sure that, I don't know. I think as a consumer, it's like, no, fuck it. That's what I want to hear. That's what I want to make. Like, yeah. I want to make an album.
I mean, we gotta fight back somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Spotify and the others, which I'm sure there'll be people listening to this on Spotify. But fuck Spotify.
We didn't mean that. We love it.
It'll just be a giant blank spot in this part of the episode.
We'll bleep it out. I'm just kidding.
But no, I mean, the streaming services have, sort of commodified music in a way that music has always been commodified, but they're changing the game in ways that aren't always clear to artists. You know, it's like playing a game that you're not really sure what the rules are.
That makes sense. Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of artists don't know, that there are other artists out there paying to be featured on Spotify Radio or Discover Mode, things like that.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah.
If you're interested, there's a book on the subject that just came out this year called Mood Machine by Liz Pelly.
Okay.
It's a very depressing book because it's a deep dive into how Spotify works, the algorithms, its history, its founders, Daniel Ek and the other guy. I don't give a fuck what his name is. He sucks too. But they were ad tech guys, you know, they were advertising people, and they were sort of they were looking to build a platform, but they didn't have a product to sell.
Okay.
And they just sort of stumbled on music as their product. And it could have just as easily been, I don't know, short form videos or whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
So they're not like music heads. They don't appreciate music on the level that artists do, or even fans of music do. I think he tweeted something the other day about like, what is music anyway? Like, he's pretending to be philosophical, and it's like, fuck you, man. I don't think you have a working definition of music.
It's funny because like I have like the relationship that like an 85-year-old man has with Spotify, which is like, I'm also, this is just the way I am with technology in general. I don't use any of their like, you know, algorithms for finding any of that. It's like I have them. I search a song or I search an album and I'll listen to it. It's like, you know, like that's my relationship.
Yeah, I know what I want to exactly, listen to exactly. And I will search for it.
But
yeah.
they spend a lot of time trying to make sure that people like you get sucked into their algorithm.
Yes.
And the algorithm does not. I mean, it's a black box. Nobody really knows how it works. Even people that work at Spotify don't have a great understanding of how it works.
And that's the way, that's my understanding of how a lot of social media. Yeah. And I think that's really how really all of social media works too, is it kind of is one giant black box, which is a little bit terrifying. I mean, you could say the same thing about YouTube. You could say the same thing about Instagram, or certainly about TikTok. It's a weird road to go down.
Yeah. And especially when we're talking about art, which is what I'm always often thinking about. It seems upsetting to me to have our culture in the hands of these fucking freaks that are building these algorithms. I'm sorry, but they don't have the best interests of the music at heart.
I really believe that.
Because they're sort of like, Spotify is actually like inventing genres. And they're putting out music, you know, the AI music is a whole nother
thing. Oh, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, we don't have to go down there. You could probably guess what my thoughts on that are.
Yeah.
But I think, yes.
Brian, I love you.
We've gone down that road a few times.
Yeah, it's a little interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just, I don't know. I don't necessarily want these people to be in the driver's seat when it comes to how music is distributed. And I don't really have the answers.
I feel like there's some degree of that though. That's just kind of inevitable. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I mean, cause when streaming like, first came out and like internet downloads and Napster and like, right. There was like a huge pushback against it, but it's like, it's going to happen. You know what I mean? Like, once that technology exists, like, even though it might not be beneficial for some people involved in creating the art, like, it's going to eventually happen.
Yeah,
like, right now, the big thing is they're trying to put into place laws of, like, because artists are worried about, like, one day AI will be able to make an album that's, like, them, and the AI, like... Like, someone will, you can just ask it, like, oh, make me another Taylor Swift album. And it'll, so they're trying to, like, put laws in place to protect about that. But, like, eventually, it's just going to be able to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Know? Well, the tools and eventually it, get out to everyone. Yeah.
But, like, you know, how long are you going to be able to push back against that before it's just like.
Yeah. It's we're going to enter a very, we're about to enter a very interesting time, I think. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very strange. And there's going to be some, like any time with massive growth and ingenuity, there's going to be some growing pains attached to it, and I think it's going to be very strange for the next little while.
Yeah, well, there is a law going through Congress right now. I don't really think it has much of a chance of passing, unfortunately, but it's called the Fairness in Streaming Act, which I think seeks to sort of remedy some of the things we're talking about, especially making sure artists are getting paid fairly through streaming services, because right now it's just kind of it's kind of a no man's land of, like, artists are not getting paid through Spotify. So I think we need to do something like that. The United Musicians for Allied Workers is a labor union that has started online, which I think is seeking to represent musicians in this day and age. Mm-hmm. I'm all for labor unions. I'm very pro-union, and I think everyone should join their local musicians union. But UMAW... is kind of a more, it feels like a more modern union for, because it's, they meet on Zoom, they have different task forces that sort of like subcommittees that attack different items. Like, they had a committee going after South by Southwest for sponsoring, money from weapons contractors coming in.
Yeah.
So it's more like 21st century.
I think I follow them on Instagram.
Yes. And they have another subcommittee about fairness in streaming. So making sure the musicians are getting paid. I think we need to do more organizing as musicians, because music is one of those things where it naturally builds solidarity. And we can bring people together. This sounds, you know, like very, you know, we just all got to love each other, but we kind of do, guys. I'm sorry, but we got to get together and play some music. We got to sing together. We got to, you know, go to protests and bring instruments, and we got to figure out how we're going to build a better world, because it's not going to just happen. I don't know. Yeah. That's where I'm at right now.
I think that's beautiful. Yeah. To kind of slightly pivot, one of the things I also wanted to ask you about was last year, I think, you put out Afterglow.
Yes.
How did all of that go? So is that your trio that you're playing with sort of regularly, or was that how did all that, because it sounds we were listening to it earlier today, it sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Thanks. That came from a collaboration with a bassist, Paul DeFiglia, and Caleb Bro, drummer. When I moved to town, I knew a lot of people already in Nashville, so I was driving down from Indy to play gigs, so I was sort of dipping my toes in the scene, liked what I saw. And then my now fiance and I moved down here about 4 years ago. And in one night I played a solo gig at Betty's.
Okay.
You ever been to Betty's? Yeah. Fantastic place. I played a solo gig cause, Caleb was doing this sort of improvised experimental music showcase where he was just inviting random people to come in, and do anything basically. Free jazz, experimental electronic music. I did a... Ooh, we got a spicy kitty over there.
Kitty, what's going on?
Nothing good, it sounds like. So he had this experimental music showcase. I played solo vibes on it. And I met like 9 people who I now count among my closest friends and collaborators here. That night went down in history.
It's so cool how shit like that happens in life.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Where it's like, I'm really glad I took that gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a hilarious gig because if you know Betty's, you know that there are a couple locals there that just come there no matter what and have probably been there for decades, no matter what music is happening. So we were playing weirdo freak music. And there were these 2 guys that were just there to watch the World Series. and it was on mute. So they were just like, you know, like something would happen. They would go, yeah. And they'd be like, well, what's this? What is that? And someone's like, that's a vibraphone. They're like, while I'm playing. Yeah. There's a video of it. You can hear it. That's hear him fantastic. Say that. It's like, he was like, well, I don't know what that is. And someone else is like, you have to, I think he went to college for that. And he's like, well, I never went to college. And it's great. He was just heckling me basically the whole time.
That's fantastic.
And everyone was like apologizing to me afterwards. It's like, no, that was great. I feel like it felt like a rite of passage.
Yeah, we've all had those gigs. You know?
Yeah. So I basically met Caleb that night, and I met Paul, the bass player, that night. And then later, after I met another drummer there named Anson Honey, and after Caleb moved to New Orleans, Anson took his place in the trio. So now Anson plays drums. So yeah, I met a ton of people there. Caleb, Paul, and I played a lot. We played Urban Cowboy. We'd play at Vinyl Tap, The Dive, a lot of different random places. Nice. Had a gig downtown at Church Street Park for a while. And that was great because we were all kind of interested in funk and Brazilian music, bossa nova, samba. Paul and Caleb were both big hip hop heads, so that kind of worked its way in too.
Nice.
So it was jazz, but we were branching out a lot, playing pop and rock
tunes. It's a very unique album. It's really cool. I really like it a lot.
And Caleb has a really unique way of playing where he's a very quiet player. His sounds are all really tight. And he has really good taste too.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, of course, is an incredible upright bass player, and I've learned a ton from playing with him. And then that was really my first record as a co-leader.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Will Tyson engineered that record, that he got the vibraphone sounding exactly the way I'd wanted, how I've always pictured vibraphones sounding. I always want vibes to be kind of like really mellow sounding. I don't play with super hard mallets because I don't want it to sound clangy. Mm-hmm. And he really made it sound like a Rhodes, you know.
What is your approach when playing with a bass player? How do you find you best have a conversation?
Well, I don't play the root notes. Okay. That's bass territory.
Exactly. One less mallet to hold.
Exactly. I don't have to. I only have four mallets anyway, so yeah.
Roots are out.
Roots are out. Yeah, first thing to go. Fifths are after that.
Perfect.
But yeah, third and seventh, and then, you know, upper extensions in the right hand, if I'm just playing chords.
Yeah.
A lot of times my top note is playing the melody, my top mallet.
Makes sense.
Because in the trio, I am the chord player and also the melodic player.
Okay, yeah.
And then the bass player is obviously playing bass, and then the drums are doing whatever it is they do over there.
Just making fucking noise.
So it's...
You ever watch a gig and you're like, this drummer could do fucking anything, doesn't he?
So yeah, it's been a learning experience because I don't have a piano player or a guitar player to comp chords underneath me. Mm-hmm. And I've really have to figure stuff out a lot more. I'm getting better, but it's really been a learning experience to try to take up more space with the vibes.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of responsibility there.
Is that again, this is just my vibraphone ignorance coming through. Is that the sort of basic vibraphone trio, like you would have like an organ trio? Is that kind of the basic layout for drums, bass, and vibraphone?
Yeah, the history of the vibraphone is so not well formed, mm-hmm, that there's not even like a standard version of that.
Okay.
Yeah, because like every marquee vibraphone player that you can name, they all just played such different music. Like Lionel Hampton was kind of the first. He played with Louis Armstrong. He was actually Louis Armstrong's drummer first. And there was just
I had no idea.
Yeah, there was a vibraphone sitting in the corner of the studio. And they're like, why don't you play that? And he's like, okay. Like, he just said yes. And that was the vibraphone as a jazz instrument was born, basically.
Yeah.
So he's the granddaddy of us all. So he was playing swing, you know. He was playing with the big bands. Milt Jackson brought bebop to the vibraphone in the 40s and 50s. He was a hard swinger, but at the same time, he was playing, you know, like he was like Charlie Parker, but for the vibraphone, but really bluesy as well. Bobby Hutcherson was a more modern player. He was 60s, 70s, 80s. I mean, he just died a few years ago. Had an incredible career, but he played marimba a lot too. Cal Chater was a Latin jazz player. Red Norvo was more, he played xylophone a lot. So they're all just different.
Yeah.
So, and Gary Burton, who's probably the most influential player for me, he was the one who really popularized four mallets.
Okay.
Because he was just such a dazzling player. Like, he's just incredible. He's just so far above everyone else as far as four mallet technique goes.
And when you're doing two mallet technique, is your role generally just melodic at that point? Is that
yeah,
kind of
you're
your
more
approach?
Of like a horn player.
Okay, that makes that sense. Point. Yeah, so the counter melody isn't or melody. That's okay.
Yeah, Gary Burton playing with four mallets kind of pioneered the pianistic style where he can comp chords and play melody at the same time.
Yeah.
And play voicings underneath. He just wanted things to sound more complete. So yeah. He just figured out a way to hold mallets. Mm-hmm. He didn't invent four mallet grip, but he invented his own version, which I use his version.
Gotcha.
It makes the most sense on the vibraphone.
Okay. Jeez, I'm learning so much today. This is amazing. This is fantastic.
I spend a lot of time thinking about this stupid instrument, so no, I could go for a long time.
No, I love it. I mean, I think that that's one of the things that we wanted to do with this is just get more, you know, get a variety, because we have drummers in here and, you know, pedal steel players and all kinds of stuff in here. But I just, it's just such a beautifully expressive instrument. I'm fascinated, but I need to go through some of the history of this and just really kind of take it in, you know, like listen to some, you got to send me a list of some real players. I'll just use all those guys.
Who are some,
yeah,
like,
there you go.
Who just are some like, modern day current guys who are kind of at the top of that?
Oh,
Who's kicking ass right now? Let's hear.
Joel Ross is the big one. He's put out some great records, through Blue Note. He plays with Micaiah McCraven, who's an awesome drummer and composer. And he has his own solo records as well. I'm a big fan of Stefan Harris. He's not really, I mean, he's been around for a couple decades now, but he's a fantastic player. Warren Wolf, fantastic. There's still just like there's very few of us. I'm pretty much the only one in Nashville, which is crazy.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I don't know of a single other vibraphone player in town.
Yeah.
Not one.
There is Jerry Tashwar, who actually lives around here. He lives in Hendersonville,
okay.
I think. And he teaches a lot. But I don't think he plays down in town a whole lot. I might be wrong. I don't know him personally. There's another guy named Lewis Wright, who moved from London a couple years ago. He's a drummer and vibraphone player, amazing vibraphone player. And when he moved to town, I was like, oh man, he's going to take all my gigs. but he didn't even bring his vibraphone to town when he moved from London.
He got lucky.
So I got lucky. So when I moved to Nashville, I made a choice. I said, I'm probably just going to focus on vibraphone, because I could have tried to get drum set gigs and I still could. But instead of being a mediocre drum set player in a sea of incredible drum set players, I decided to just go for the vibraphone thing and be like, I'll just be the only vibraphone player.
Hey, that's a smart way to do it, you know?
It's a good move.
But Lewis went in the other direction. He had to make a choice as well. Mm-hmm. And he's decided that he's like, I'm just going to focus on drums.
Yeah, that's awesome.
As he should, because he's an incredible drum set player as well.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when you're a multi-instrumentalist, you have to, branding becomes a concern. Where, you know, when you're shaking someone's hand, you got to be like, Parker James, vibraphone, how the hell are you? You know, you can't be like, I play vibraphone, but also I play drums. Don't forget about that. You know, it's just, it's too complicated.
Yeah.
So I just decided
to streamline it.
To go with the weird, memorable instrument. You know?
It's a smart move. That's a smart move.
It is a good move.
Yeah.
Because how many good drummers are in this town?
That's true. Yeah, when I was playing around more, I would play primarily as a harmonica player. And it's funny because it was like, there's like three of us in town, one of whom is Charlie McCoy. So it's like, you know, okay, I'm not kidding.
He's a vibraphone player too.
The man plays literally everything.
Yeah, all those old like Nashville sound records all have vibraphone on it. And that was him. It would be criminal of me not to mention Charlie McCoy when I'm talking about vibraphone players in Nashville. He's still around. He's still working. Yeah. You can hire him for a session, you know?
One of the things too that I wanted to talk about is just your approach on the instrument through different genres. So I know you primarily do jazz around town, but when you do branch off to other styles, how does your approach change? What is the role of how does the rule of the instrument change in different genres?
That's a really good question. I'm always trying to fit vibes into different genres. Because I really think it is a versatile instrument. I really think that it can fit in a lot of different contexts. Mm-hmm. I'm always trying to convince people like not to hire a keyboard player, just hire me instead. Yeah. Sorry, keyboard players, but you know, it's a dog eat dog world out there. I'm just always trying to create opportunities mm-hmm. because a lot of people don't know what to do with the vibraphone. Some people know they want it and they're looking for a vibraphone player and they Google vibraphone Nashville and then they get me. But other people, they hear it and they're like, whoa, that's cool. I instead of having Fender Rhodes or guitar, I could use this sound and it's a unique sound.
Yeah.
So I find myself kind of like in playing with like indie rock or indie pop. I play with a band called Volunteer Department, which is a rock band. And I'm almost like the lead guitar in that band sometimes.
Mm. That's a really cool role to fill. That's awesome. Yeah.
Because I'm trying to play the melodic notes, but also I can play chords mm-hmm. too. So it's just a matter of what the song needs at the time. I've played, you know, Americana music, with guys like Josh Halper, where I'm doing a lot of that, you know, yeah. I'm playing melodies and adding color. Because gotcha. A lot of times people just want the color of the vibes. Mm-hmm. So like if I'm doing like a remote session, I've recorded my home studio a lot. They'll send me a track and they'll be like, I just
add
want
vibes. Yeah.
They say add vibes. And I go, okay. And I add vibes and they go, great. You know? So it's a lot of times I'm just sort of getting that sound.
Yeah. I feel like it's kind of similar to like pedal steel in the sense that it's just like, there's a certain sound and they want that sound. And
Yeah, and evokes, like, you hear pedal steel, and it evokes memories of, like, fireflies in a field in Kentucky, you know, at dusk or something like that. You know, when you hear vibes, I don't know what you feel, but I guess it depends on the context. But it really does add a specific color that I think some people just want. Yeah.
And I think, like, steel is such a malleable instrument. I mean, and like I said earlier, it's so expressive and it's so like vocal in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's so much you can do with it outside of just like sprinkling it on top.
Yeah. And there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of techniques you can use. Like bowing a vibraphone sounds crazy. It sounds like a synth almost, mm-hmm. like a really high synth.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So you can do like pad stuff with that. If I have incredibly soft mallets, I can roll. And I can just create a sustain.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I've done ambient sets, full like hour long ambient sets on vibraphone alone with no electronics.
Oh, interesting.
And it usually involves me using the like cello and bass bows or really soft mallets to create like an ambiance. I like doing that kind of stuff too. My friend Neil Frid threw a 12-hour ambient set. It was an overnight sleep. It was an ambient sleepover, he called it.
Damn.
He had this sort of like converted garage behind his house, and he the whole floor was covered in mattresses, uh-huh. and he had bunk beds in there, and he was projecting visuals. He had some projectionists projecting visuals, and he had some movies and stuff.
That's really cool.
And everyone took turns. There were a bunch of ambient artists that came in and did an hour at a time. And I had the 7 a.m. shift, I think. So I was there in the evening. Then I went home and slept a few hours. And then I came back at like 6:30 in the morning.
Was there like overlap? So one guy would be going and then you come in. Do you have to like, I assume they don't want the ambience to stop. Yeah. So you have transition somehow.
Yeah, 12 hours of sound.
That's
continuous
cool.
sound.
That's really fucking cool. Who was before you? Who did you have to like jump on?
Oh, who was before me? Oh,
or I should say like what instrument was before you?
It was electronics. Okay, it was electronics. And then, it was electronics after me too.
Interesting. So you were couched in some. Okay. Yeah,
I was the only pure acoustic instrument in there.
Yeah. Man, you're so much cooler than them. No.
But there were about 15 people there that were kind of in and out of consciousness through the whole time. And some people told me they like woke up to like vibraphone happening and they were just like, what the fuck?
That's kind of cool though. So what's next on the horizon for you? What do you got coming up?
Oh, geez. I have a standing gig at Vinyl Tap every Tuesday, the second and fourth Thursday of every month. My trio plays.
Oh, nice.
So that's with Paul and Anson. So I do that all the time.
Wait, so when's the next one? Am I trying to think.
We just played this last Thursday.
Okay,
so,
gotcha. Okay.
So we'll be playing...
Because I got to come check that out. That'll be killer.
Yeah, the fourth Thursday of June we'll be playing
gotcha.
Next.
Gotcha, okay. Heck yeah.
And then I play with a guy named Rich Ruth, who does ambient jazz, space jazz, he calls it. So I play vibraphone and percussion in that. We're playing Newport Jazz Fest in Rhode Island in August.
Nice.
Which is a huge honor for me to be able to play that festival.
That's amazing.
I just wanted to go to that damn thing and listen to the music, but now I'm getting to play there, which is
that's amazing.
Very special.
Congrats, man. That's killer.
So that's happening. And other than that, I do a lot of stuff in town. I'm not on the road a whole lot.
That's kind of nice, though.
It's kind of nice. Yeah. That's why I liked Nashville, is because that's you can do that in this town. Mm-hmm. I can take road gigs when the time's right, or when it makes sense financially. But for now, I'm content to work at the Mallet Factory and play gigs with my trio and play with volunteer department and play with Rich and just sort of take songwriter gigs when they come up. I feel like I have a very rich life in music here, and I owe it entirely to the fact that Nashville is just such a diverse music scene. And hell the community is really,
and
really
people
tight-knit.
Look out for each other, and as much as there's such an influx of new people constantly coming in, it seems like everyone here just wants to be here for good reason and enjoys it. You know?
Yeah. There's a kind of a revolving door of people, which is both good and bad. But it's always bringing fresh people in.
Yeah.
Like I was here like a week, and I met someone who had moved here since I had moved here. So I was like no longer the newest person in Nashville. It's like, shit. Okay.
You stop being the new guy fast here.
Yeah, totally. I'm really thankful for what the city has given me so far. And I'm stoked for what's next. I don't know what the fuck's next, but
dude,
we'll see.
That's what life's for. This is amazing. Dude, again, thank you so much for doing this. The pieces sound awesome. Like I'm really excited to hear how those turn out. Cause they were really beautiful.
Yeah, me too.
They were killer.
Send me those files.
You'll get everything.
Yeah. Use that shit. Dude, thank you.
Cool, man. Let's do it.
Appreciate it.